Joseph P. Farrell is our guest, and we are talking about the book Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, and of course the follow-up to this, Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations. I want to ask Joseph a little bit later where he goes with this, of course, but before we get into that, I want to ask you about the consistency of where the current elite are taking us, pretty much, because you had a very interesting news item on your website about Zbigniew Brzezinski, about how he basically has gone out now and said that the Eurozone and America should form a trading bloc against China.
Yeah. Zbigniew Brzezinski, to me, Henrik, he's one of these people that you know, perish the thought, but you wonder when they're going to die. You know, he's very old. He just keeps going, and he gets crazier, it seems, with every incarnation. his big concern in that post was, you know, he's looking at the same phenomenon. He's looking at these BRICS nations and the emergence of a geopolitical and economic bloc that he sees as a danger and threat to the West. And I suppose to a certain extent he's correct. It can certainly be construed that way. But the problem is that we've been looking at more and more nations working out bilateral agreements with China to bypass the dollar altogether as a reserve currency. Most recently, it was Australia and France. So, you know, I suspect that if France goes, then Germany's not too far behind.
Right.
So,
yeah.
This is, I think, a desperate way that the financial oligarchs in the City of London and New York are trying to keep, number one, keep the Eurozone together, and number two, keep it under their thumb. I don't think it's going to work simply because of the economic factor. Too much now of the American productivity and financial resources and so on are going to support this enormous military-industrial complex. I mean, we spend in this country more, I think, than the next largest nations together spend on defense.
Yeah.
So in other words, we're spending all this money to keep this enormous national security state empire going. And eventually, you know, we're going to find ourselves in exactly the same position as Venice. We're going to find ourselves financially exhausted and surrounded by enemies that have just about had it. And, you know, we know what happened to Venice, and I'm seeing signs of that now. If traditional allies like France are bolting from the dollar, then we can look for other countries that are our allies to do the same eventually too. And this, I think, was Brzezinski's way of trying to shore up the eroding base of Western power. I don't think it's going to work. Certainly Europe trades a lot with the United States, and that's going to continue. But selling that package to Europe right now, I think, is a bit dodgy. I don't see America as having a very good reputation or face to present in Europe. I know that if I were a European, I'd be immensely skeptical.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, I just don't see that this is going to work. And, you know, Brzezinski's thinking in classical oligarchical terms that, well, first comes the economic and trade agreements, and then comes the political influence. Well, you know, I've got bad news for him. I think Europeans are pretty fed up with American political influence in Europe, too. So I just don't think it's going to fly. But, I think Zbigniew is just playing his same old game, you know, try to contain Russia and the emerging Chinese bloc. I just don't think it's going to work.
The theorized idea that the euro is going to collapse, crash, what have you, has been circulating for years now, and it doesn't.
Yeah.
Despite all of this, it doesn't seem to happen. I've always held an idea and a theory since this whole circus began that ultimately the eurozone is looking at strengthening itself, and it's by actually weakening the nations one by one and getting more control over them, over their bank system, and getting them further deeper in debt. And with the application of the, you know, the European stability mechanism and everything else, putting these nations in tremendous debt, that this is going to actually, at the end of it, make sure that the Eurozone never is going to collapse. It's actually going to, in the long term, strengthen it. What do you make of an idea like that, Joseph?
Oh, I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. I think this is ultimately the agenda that's been driving the powers that be in Brussels and Frankfurt and Berlin. I think this is precisely what they're trying to do. Whether or not it's going to succeed in cases like Spain or Italy, I mean, my word, in Spain, unemployment, I've heard figures now are almost approaching 40 to 50%, depending on which source you look at. And I don't see that you can sustain a political agenda with those kinds of numbers. In other words, they're going to have to ameliorate their policy at some point if they want to keep those nations on the bandwagon. I just don't see any other way to do it. Either that, or they're going to have to clamp down so hard that, again, I don't know that the populations they're dealing with are going to sit idly by and take it. Particularly in those countries with their memories of fascism being so recent. So, you know, I tend to agree with you on the one hand. I think that's their policy. I think that's what they've got in the back of their mind. But on the other hand, I think that the popular outcry has been something that they probably didn't expect. And bargain for. And the real test case is going to be, I think, is going to come in France and Germany, particularly when they try and implement those kinds of policies in those countries, which inevitably they're going to have to do if you're correct, and I think that you probably are, that this debt mechanism is the way that they're going to try and force all of these countries into a much tighter union. The piper is going to come in France and Germany. That's where we're going to see the real test case.
But how about two different currencies, as Germany is looking at right now? On one hand, they want to get out of the euro, but and bring partially back the Deutschmark and everything. I mean, is this
right?
What is that all about?
Well, I think that's part of the popular revolt. The Germans, you know, are now being asked to be the locomotive for Europe. They're being asked to bail out everybody else.
And let me ask you this before you carry on, Joseph. Sure. Should they? Is the economic situation in these other countries, is that indirectly or directly Germany's fault, so quote unquote, if you will?
Well, I think in some cases you can argue that it is their fault. But in some cases, I think it's more the fault of the domestic policies of the governments concerned. But the long and short of it is that you have a population in Germany that's going to be increasingly restive as they see their standard of living and their hard work start to erode.
That's right.
That's going to be, and I think you're already seeing the popular backlash with the calls for the return to the Deutschmark and so on and so forth. And I don't think, you know, if Germany thinks that they can have it both ways, you know, have their Europe and eat it too, then, history has a way of repeating itself here. And I just don't see the rest of Europe going along with that. And I, for that matter, I don't see the German people who've experienced their own immigration problems and so on and so forth and seen the policy consequences of their governments over the long term, I don't think they're going to sit idly by either and watch this slip into kind of a Euro-fascism recur. In fact, of all the people in Europe, I think that would be the most restive against it, it's going to be the Germans. So it's going to be interesting to watch. France and Germany in particular, I think, are going to be very interesting countries to keep an eye on in the next 3 to 5 years.
Well, exactly. I mean, there's so much of policy that is being run from there. And at the same time, you have, I think you linked up this as well from, I think it was from the Daily Bell, basically talking about these, the potential schism. And this kind of alludes a little bit to what we talked about earlier in terms of Boston. Right. And you have this intense polarization happening within Germany. You have certain people coming aboard that still have their feet pretty much in the old banking establishment, but they're openly, putting themselves as the opposition to it, right? Wasn't that one of the stories you linked up?
Yeah, the Daily Bell takes the line that a lot of this is theater that, you know, it's the typical bankster game of playing both ends against the middle and having everything well in hand and under control. I don't incline to that view. I think the political tensions in Europe are genuine. I think particularly so in cases like Spain or Italy or Germany. I think that, you know, I've already spoken in the previous section about Germany's diplomatic tightrope. You know, on the one hand, they seem to be playing the role of lap poodle to London and New York rather well. And then on the other hand, they do curious things like insist that, you know, we give them all of their gold back and do so pronto, you know.
Yeah.
The game that they're playing, to me, is very interesting in that it's the typical German foreign policy that we saw all the way up to the outbreak of World War II, from the founding of the German Empire in 1871 all the way up to the outbreak of World War II. Germany was always playing this kind of balance of power act between the East and the West, and I think that you're seeing the reassertion of that traditional role, which means you're seeing the reassertion of a much more independent Germany. So, you know, where all this is going to play out, I don't know. But I suspect the more independent Germany acts, that this is an indicator that quietly and behind the scenes, they've got some very strong support from Moscow and Beijing. So the stronger Germany struts, that means that they've got some quiet assurances lurking in the background that haven't hit the news pages yet.
Well, it's interesting. I think it's the alternative German party, Bernhard Lucke, or Bernd Lucke, or something is his name. I mean, the question is, does this ultimately strengthen nationalism, you know, throughout the various countries in Europe, or will it at the end completely break it apart? It's like this could go either way right now. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it can go either way, and I'm glad you pointed out the nationalism in Europe, because this is something else I think is lurking and bubbling and simmering beneath the scenes. Let's take the case of Greece. You cannot go into a country like Greece and be Goldman Sachs, for example, and think that you're literally going to take over all of Greece's antiquities as collateral.
Yeah.
And, you know, and expect the Greeks to roll over and play dead. I mean, you know, the Greeks ferociously resisted the Nazi occupation. And certainly, you know, as in Greece and every other country in Europe, you had collaborators. But by and large, Greece, like Yugoslavia, proved to be a difficult thing to handle. And the same thing I think you're going to see. In fact, you've already seen in Italy the attempt of the financial oligarchs to kind of tap into the growing resistance with, what was his name, that ran for office in Italy, Draghi or something like that.
Beppe Grillo?
Yeah, the comedian.
Yeah.
You know, that tapped into this growing nationalist spirit in Italy. And again in Spain, you know, you're going to find the same thing going on. So this is the problem. The Eurozone is a wonderful idea economically and politically, but the fact of the matter is, culturally, it's a bit different. You cannot federate these disparate cultures quite as easily as was the case over here in this country. So it's going to be interesting to see how all this plays out. And right now I'm kind of the opinion, Henrik, it's kind of a 50-50 choice. It could go either way.
Well, indeed. Yeah, I agree with you on that. Now, earlier you said basically that the BRICS nations have also at the same time kind of seen through this, and ultimately that they are kind of targeted for this, that there is a bigger agenda. Maybe we can just talk about that a little bit more, what the evidence for the BRICS nations kind of seeing a larger agenda at play here, what that is.
Well, I think for the BRICS people, it depends pretty much on the individual nation that you're talking about. In each nation's case, they have a history that they know very well of Western malfeasance and you know, corrupt practice using cutouts and covert operations and so on. My word. If you go to China, the whole Chinese Opium Wars was quite literally an event that was fought over the British Empire's attempt to to keep China weak by addicting it to drugs. That's putting it simplistically, but that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And the Chinese, you know, certainly know their own history and know the financial demons that they're dealing with in London and New York. By the same token, in Russia, it's very interesting that just prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union, something very interesting began to happen. You began to see books being printed in Russia that concerned, you know, the international banking cabal. And even in a couple of cases, books that were indicting the Communist Party as having, you know, been basically the creature of bankers in London and New York.
Yeah.
And then, of course, came the Soviet collapse, and then you found the rise of Vladimir Zhirinovsky and these ultra-fascist parties inside of Russia that openly paraded these types of ideas as part of their party platform. And, you know, sad to say, it's these things are true. The sadness is that they were co-opted by parties of the extreme right, these ideas. But nonetheless, you find the ideas having some currency in Russia. And then again, you turn to India. Well, you know, you don't have to be that familiar with the history of the British Empire to realize that, again, if you're Indian, this whole Western financial oligarchy literally plundered your country,
yeah,
you know, for two centuries. And again, South Africa, you know, consider the history there. First apartheid and then the Boer Wars and a familiarity with Western policy and duplicity concerning all of that. Each of these nations has some sort of legitimate historical grievance against these financial oligarchs in the West. So that's, I think, in one part driving them. The other thing that they look at that I'm convinced, Henrik, I don't know about you and what your perceptions are coming from Europe, but from my perspective, if I were these nations looking at post 9/11 America and its behavior on the world stage, I would be alarmed. And my cause for alarm would be not simply the fact that we had an Iraqi invasion over a pretense that proved to be false. We are watching Western covert operations bring down regime after regime in the Middle East and replacing supposedly moderate secular regimes with the most rabidly radical types of Islamicism that you can think of.
Mm.
I think there are Western footprints all over this in Syria.
Sure.
You know, it doesn't take too much to see that.
They're setting up their future enemy. That's what they're doing.
Yes, exactly. 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 They're setting up their future enemy for a clash of civilizations conflict. And if you're the BRICS nations and you're looking at these developments, you are bound to look at them with some alarm, because basically what's being organized is a bipolar world, and you're trying to make sure that it's a tripolar world, at least. And I think in that respect they might be somewhat successful. But, you know, you've got to look at American interventionism since 9/11 and unilateralism with some alarm if you're one of these countries. So, yeah, I think to a certain extent, it's their history driving them, it's current perceptions, it's the weakness of the dollar, or the perceived weakness of the dollar, whichever it may be, and the move to bilateral currency agreements to bypass the dollar. I think that's going to escalate. I'm just hoping that sane heads are going to eventually prevail somehow in Washington. given what we've seen in the last 2 to 3 years,
yeah.
I'm not optimistic. So.
No. Well, again, I'm also thinking further the long term of how, because at this stage it's pretty much accepted around the world that the whole Iraq war, as you said, is based on a fraud and lies, and yet this is continuing at this stage. But I can't help to think, okay, so how will this disillusionment and anger that everyone feels, and rightly so, against their own country, their own authority, governments, security agencies, what have you, military, how that is potentially going to be steered and used as well in the future. Because as you pointed out, Joseph, they've always put their puppets in place to keep a country in disarray, you know, right, with the strategy of tension. We're stuck between these extreme fascist regimes and these extreme communist regimes. We're stuck right between a rock and a hard place, and they use each other right to propagate one agenda. And it's like, do you want national socialism or do you want international socialism? It's all fascism to me, you know?
Yes. Yeah, it's fascism of a different color. Well, I think, I honestly don't know how it's going to play out, but I do think that the internet is going to play a crucial role, and here's why. I've said many times, half jokingly, that, you know, I'm thoroughly bipartisan. I loathe dummy crooks and Republic thugs equally.
Yeah.
And I mean that quite literally, because there is no real party of opposition in this country to what's going on. There are attempts here and there to create them. I suspect that this is an international mood. It's not merely an American one. I suspect that it's very strong in Europe. I suspect it's very strong in Canada, Australia, you know, wherever you look. I think one of the things that we have to do is we have to start organizing some sort of voice for the political center, which has been all but denuded of any representation in this country. And I can't speak for Europe, but I suspect there as well. That's priority number one. We've got to quit thinking in terms of these polarities, these extreme polarities, and start thinking in terms of what it means to be in the political center and representative of a particular national culture again. This, to me, is paramount. And this, incidentally, I think is the strength of the BRICS nations. You look at them, and while they all appear to have an authoritarian government of one sort or another, those governments do appear to be trying, at least, to do something for the public good of their nation. This is, I think, particularly the case when you look at countries like India or Brazil. But you look at this country, and the political parties function as nothing but lap poodles for the corporations. That's basically all they are anymore. They don't represent the public good of the country, and there's no real debate that's taking place. And that's the second part of the problem. The internet now is where the debate on issues is taking place. You may agree with the issues, you may disagree, but certainly there's more debate on the internet about these things than you'll find on any of the major American media outlets. You know, we've talked about this theory and that theory of the Boston Marathon bombing. Imagine seeing our discussion or hearing our discussion on CNN or on faux news, as I like to call Fox.
Yeah.
You know, imagine this kind of discussion on those networks. It won't happen. It won't happen. They're not really news reporting networks anymore. They're perception management networks, and that's half the problem right there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wonder how much they know that they are dying, if you will, as well, like a dying breed. Like this is. They know that they're part of the old media, and also at the same time, I'm also therefore wary of how much of alternative are they going to move into, not from the point of view of television, of course, but let's say their right online coverage and things like that. Yeah, I don't know. Just things that I think about in the background as I see news stories pop up here and there in the mainstream media. There's like starting to go towards the slant. Either it's like completely criticizing it, all our alternatives as being some kind of nutcases or what have you, or it's kind all of right beginning to fester into it, to kind of be part of it. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Well, I think there's some of that. You can go on some of those major media outlets on their internet websites and see stories that you'll never see them covering on air, on mm-hmm television, mm, or on the radio talk shows that they also sponsor. I think there's a certain amount of that is taking place. And I think to a certain extent that may represent an attempt by those media conglomerates to break into the internet. But I think as far as the internet community itself goes, they long ago lost any moral capital that they had with people that use the internet for news sources. And I don't think they're going to get it back. And I think that's what's driving, ultimately, the power of these oligarchs to try and regulate the internet. They have not been able to win on the battleground of ideas, or more importantly, research. That's where they're losing the battle. You know, and I've got bad news for them. Even if they are successful in capturing and regulating the internet, there's the good old technology of the book. And now, you know, with internet on-demand publishing, with, you know, laser printers being cheap, with copy companies offering to do binding, and the technology now allows samizdat-type book publications way beyond anything that happened in the former Soviet Union. So, you know, they're faced with a real information management crisis. The technology is democratizing ideas, allowing people to get a hold of ideas that are out of the mainstream, out of the approval of the mainstream. That's their big problem, and I don't think that they have many solutions right now.
Yeah, and also just to tie back to the Boston bombings, we had the House of Representatives, they did pass the CISPA security bill, yeah, basically right during all this event. It's a sleight of hand as something is a major focus like this on an event like that. You know, I always question, okay, wait a minute, when everyone's looking at point A, what's happening, you know, around everywhere else, and what are they trying to push in under the radar?
Exactly. You know, it's amazing to me, you know, this is the theme, the playbook that keeps being repeated over and over again. And we first saw evidence of it during the Oklahoma City bombing in this country, because there was already an anti-terrorism bill, you know, kind of the predecessor to the Patriot Act, that was waiting in the wings. And bang, as soon as the Oklahoma City bombing occurred, it was rammed through Congress, lickety-split.
Yeah.
Republican Congress and a Democratic president, and, you know, bang, that was it.
They're all behind it at that point. No division
at
all.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Same with CISPA, by the way. There was one comment, yeah, you know, about the Republicans and the Democrats have come together in this point because the Boston has demonstrated that we, you know, need to use this, you know, to regulate, yeah, the web pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same old bipartisan, you know, beret. It's this dance that they perform of pretended opposition, you know, because, again, are these bills really protecting anybody? No. They're expanding the power of the government. They're expanding the power of the political class, sure. But are they protecting you and me? No. No, they're not protecting us. So, you know, again, I go back to the premise that we began with the first segment. Are all the security cameras, are all the billions of dollars, are all the gropings by the Heimat sicher Heit Dienst at the, you know, airports, are all of these things protecting us? No, they're not doing it at all. They didn't prevent this from happening. So why this move to give away not just our constitutional liberties, Henrik? We have to remember that these rights are a part of Anglo-American jurisprudence that date back to the Magna Carta.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have no sympathy, you know, I'll say it again, I have no sympathy for these national security state people, be they in the Dummy Crook Party or the Republithug Party. Every time we have an event like this, we need to rush and pass some other national security bill. No, we need to start repealing them because they are not making us any safer at all.
Well, I mean, it's obvious. I mean, I don't know how people can't see it, that the more the government claims that they're supposed to protect you, but yet more and more of these incidents and accidents and false flag events keep happening. So people
right.
get a question: what good does it do? Nothing at all.
Nothing at all. Well, the other thing is, you know, if these are false flag events, if these are actually real operations that are piggybacked on drills, that requires inside knowledge. And when you're feeding the monster by expanding the very government and national security apparatus that is performing these things, the only thing that's going to result is more of them.
That's right.
Not less.
Yeah.
So in other words, you know, as far as I'm concerned, these types of things are feeding the monster. They're not curing it. They're not killing it. They're not doing anything for protection. You know, all of the billions spent to snoop on all the emails and eavesdrop on all the phone calls didn't prevent this. And even when the Russian intelligence services tipped us off about these two, that still didn't prevent it. So, you know, come on here.
Yeah, I know, exactly. I mean, we're going in the completely wrong direction. The more fear and terror that's being spread, the more we should, you know, the security apparatus should be dismantled. It should go in the opposite direction. And this is obviously something that's very, very difficult for people to understand. But the basic outline here is that we also have people who are part of these organizations that have a invested interest in just maintaining their government money that they're granted every year. In fact, they want to have more. They want to expand. We want to have even more security.
Precisely. If your product is security, how do you sell the product? Well, you create demand. How do you create demand? Well, you stage incidents. See, you know, we could have prevented this if only we had more of that. Well, you know, that's the problem. it's kind of good old free market economics in practice here is what I'm suggesting. And you know,
exactly. Are they doing a bad job? Okay, well, you need to look somewhere else for the service.
Exactly. You know, we have a national security intelligence apparatus and a whole literal alphabet soup of agencies. You know, ONI, ONR, DIA, CIA, NSA, FBI, on and on we could go. And, you know, the State Department even has its own little intelligence service. For crying out loud, with all of these agencies, this still happened. With all of those agencies, 9/11 still happened. So, you know, my first inclination is, no, you don't need to pass more national security acts and expand this structure. You need to pull a Philippe Labelle, you know, King of France, a Friday the 13th, and have your seneschals all throughout France go raid the temple on the same day under sealed orders. That's what needs to be done. And if we find that the Templars have absconded with the treasure when we do that, then we know all along they were up to no good. it's pretty much that simple.
Yeah. Oh boy. Yeah, it's a very, very interesting turn of events and developments. And we're heading in. It's more and more of this seems to come, and every time it comes, it's used for the purposes of the advancements of this very nightmare that we're talking about now.
Yep.
A little bit later here, I might want to just get into a little bit more on covert wars and the clash of civilizations in terms of what you see with this. But I wanted to throw a couple of other things into the mix here first and just ask you about this. The Catholics, they got themselves a new pope during this chaotic time as well, by the way.
Yeah.
How do you interpret this? What happened here, if you have any opinions on this?
Well, I don't know. The bottom line is I don't know. But here's my problem. We went from Razzi the Nazi to an Argentinian pope. Now, that little coincidence right there just raises all sorts of red flags. I just really don't even want to say what I'm really thinking here. secondly, the man is a Jesuit, and again, that raises all sorts of red flags, because the whole purpose of the Jesuit order, like it or not, is to preserve, protect, and expand the powers of the papacy based on its claims. So, I have to look at the history of the institution and the order itself. And that gives me great pause. But the third thing I see in this is it's a real change for the Roman hierarchy. They've read the tea leaves, and the tea leaves are that the center of power in the church is shifting away from Europe and to the third world. So what I think this represents is an attempt to maintain the European cultural hold on the Vatican by picking a cardinal from a country in Latin America that clearly has third world ties that can represent that aspect of the political realignment taking place within the Roman Church, but that also has clear, I mean, you know, you only have to visit Buenos Aires or other places in Argentina to see and feel like you're in an extension of Europe.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that this is significant because it's a long-term change that you just saw occur inside the Vatican. I think that you're going to see now a string of popes probably coming from Latin America, perhaps from Africa as well in the future. Francis, how long he lasts, I don't know. I don't think that he's in the best of health. And that brings me to the fourth and final consideration. I think that he is a transition pope to something else. But that something else is going to be reflected in the long-term evaluation of the situation that you see reflected in the person of Francis himself. And that's a move away from Europe.
Yeah, I've been tracking. There are a lot of invested groups, of course, in the European Union and everything else. But to me, it's sure. been surprising how many are Jesuits or Roman Catholics that are in positions of high power within the European Union. And
oh, yes.
We have interactions, pretty strong interactions with the Knights of Malta and you know, the representatives in the European Union, the Parliament and everything else are
yep.
ties in this. So the question here is, are they trying to, what we saw in the past with the strong Catholic Church, we have things like the a history of all these, not only wars, but what I'm thinking about is, I can't believe I'm forgetting it now, the going to the Middle East, the Crusades, the Holy Crusades, basically.
Right, right.
That the expansion of this is like still an important kind of, background kind of agenda here. What do you make of it?
Well, I look at it this way, Henrik. I think that it's been a long-term agenda of certain groups, certain types of people within Europe to regain the power that was lost as a result of the Reformation and, more importantly, as a result of the Renaissance. You're asking a question about a long-term agenda there, and hopefully my book that's coming out this fall, The Financial Vipers of Venice, will at least try and lay the groundwork for some of an answer. But, yeah, I do see a pattern of influence. And one of the things that I want to draw to people's attention in that respect are the recent pronouncements by the Vatican that the world needs a central moral authority and that the world needs a central, you know, a central unified currency. These were both statements that came out of the Vatican just shortly before Ratzinger's resignation and the election of Francis. And I suspect that they may be connected. All of these events inside the Vatican may be connected. Now, for the papacy to be calling for a central world moral consultative authority is, of course, pressing the papal claim once again. You know, I trust this institution just about as far as I can throw it to be a central, you know, consultative moral authority for the world. This is the same institution that used to burn people alive for disagreeing with it.
And yeah, yeah.
I make no bones about that. I have Roman Catholic relatives in my family. And, you know, I've been equally up forward and up front with them. This institution has certain claims, and it has not hesitated to use, incidentally, terrorism, which I think you have to look at this idea of the auto da fe as being. You have to look at its applied use of terrorism to enforce those claims in the past. And I think given enough power, like any institution, it will corrupt and slip into some very, very barbaric practices. It did so in the past. It can do so again. So I look at what's going on in the European Union, these papal pronouncements and calls for a global currency. I think the papacy could end up, or may even be angling, to be connected with that central moral authority and with that central financial authority. I think there's every prospect of that taking place. And that sounds far out. That sounds implausible. But it's a powerful institution. It's deeply woven into the fabric of Western culture. Not so much Eastern European culture, because that's Orthodox, obviously. But yeah. In terms of Western culture, yes. And with the backdrop of an engineered clash of civilizations with Islam, you betcha it would play a very central role, just as it used to. So, yeah, I see that role, however, as being more along the lines of an ecumenical pope. In other words, a pope that deliberately tries to position himself to be the spokesman for the ecumenical movement, for all of Christianity. And, of course, you're going to have segments of Christianity that object to that. But it's going to be a restructuring along papal lines of using the papacy to represent Western Christian civilization as a symbol, as opposed to Islamic civilization and so on and so forth. So, and they know this very well in the Vatican. There's no doubt in my mind that they know that this is the game and that they're going to play along with it.
Okay, yeah, that's a very interesting point. Are they playing along, or are they? Are they setting up the game entirely? Because at the same time, we have a very, well, it's a powerful Islam that would never accepted, you know, the Rome or the Vatican as the moral center of the world. No way. And at the same time, right, there is a, you know, Islam is making its way into Europe currently. There are many people within, right, Europe considering this to be a threat. This would be a further polarized element, basically, which could lead to, as was kind of alluding to earlier, basically a new kind of a crusade almost, if you will. How far can this go?
It can go very far, unfortunately, because I think the game afoot, I'll be very blunt and honest here, I think the game afoot is to present the Islamic world, Islamic culture, over the long term in the worst possible light possible, to emphasize the barbarism in the religion. And I pull no punches there either. There is an inherent barbarism in it. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is, if you look at the so-called secular governments within the world of Islam, particularly Kemal Ataturk, you'll find this attempt to secularize and move away from it as much as possible. There were certainly barbarities that were perpetrated under the Turks during World War I. The Armenian massacre and so on and
so
forth.
Yeah, that's right.
So I'm not trying to read that out of the record. I'm simply saying that these secular governments, I think, were a little bit more capable of maintaining internal tensions and balances and less inclined to the kind of radicalism that we see emerging now. And that radicalism, I think, is a kind of basic Islamic fundamentalism that you see being expressed. I think that tendency, they are going to deliberately exacerbate that as much as they can to set up this clash of civilization. And I'll be very blunt and honest, I think the long-term agenda is to set the whole Islamic culture up for a fall.
Well, I really do. Definitely, and at the same time, this could be the very force that actually also, quote-unquote, unifies Europe for a common goal, if you will. I mean, this is something, right, I talked about back in 2010 when I did my talk in Bath on the European Union. I had this thought that, as I was putting that together, that it's almost like they're gonna sanction a certain level of behavior. They might even actually be in a position where they... And this is, you know, again, going far and wide, you know, out there on a limb, if you will, but actually...
Sure.
Causing a bit of intentionally causing cultural, you know, tensions basically by aiding,
yes,
immigration coming, letting that into Europe and causing a cultural kind of strategy of tension to occur kind of dynamically as it does. I mean, you can't just put two ancient cultures next to each other side by side and expect nothing to happen from that. And that's the agenda. That's the goal. That's what I saw.
Yeah, and I agree with you, and I think there's every danger of a kind of fundamentalist Christian cultural backlash, and I'm not talking about the American version of it either. I'm talking about something much more Catholic and historically based inside of European culture. Because you do have those fascist movements and parties within various Western European countries. They've always been there. And it's always been a strong element of those parties to have this kind of broadly Christian cultural commitment. Particularly in France, you find that to be the case, and to a lesser extent in Spain, the Falangists and Catholicism and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I think that's a danger. I think it's real. I think it's a long-term agenda that they have. The fly in the ointment, as far as that agenda is concerned, is orthodoxy, because it will not accept the papacy or any of its claims. To do so is to betray orthodoxy. And the other problem is orthodoxy works much more efficiently as Catholicism. I mean, we've already talked about Vladimir Putin and his orthodoxy and how it is bound up with Russian culture and so on and so forth. This is all setting up Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. I mean, it's all very, very clear. Now, I want to qualify in terms of the book that I'm writing now, Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations. That's kind of hovering in the background as a backdrop to what I'm really writing about in the book, because my thesis is, again, borrowed basically from Richard Dolan, who had the idea that this breakaway civilization is formed in the Cold War matrix. So in other words, the Cold War mentality is how they're approaching everything, including the problem of UFOs. So when I say Clash of Civilizations, I'm thinking that they're getting ready for, the really big one, and that it's not down here on Earth. if you're confronted with a, just stop and think, if you're in that Cold War national security mentality, and you're confronted with what appears to you to be a technologically sophisticated extraterrestrial threat, then do you go to war with that threat right away? Well, no. The first thing you do is take care of home base. In other words, put it on earthly terms. Before you invade Russia, you've got to take care of France. So, putting it in that perspective, these oligarchs would want to secure their base of operations on Earth, and that means you've got to eliminate some of the competition and get the others on board with you before you tackle the really big threat, which is the long-term one. I think that's in play here. I know that sounds wild, that sounds crazy, but I do think that the perception of UFOs is that they were hostile.
And how real is that assessment? Is it or real? But how accurate is that assessment, do you think?
I think it's very accurate.
Really?
Yeah, I do. And the reason why is that both of the superpowers back during the Cold War had major defense, nuclear and thermonuclear defense installations violated by UFOs numerous times. And in both superpowers' cases, as I detailed in Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, both superpowers were confronted with UFOs that would turn their ICBMs on and off and retarget them. And in the Russians' case, at one point, they actually appeared over an ICBM base and started the launch sequence. So in other words, they would have had to have been perceived as being provocative and a potential threat. There's no other way of assessing it, and there would have been a deep but covert response to that threat. So I think that this is in play. It's the hidden factor. It's the factor that sounds kooky when you first hear about it. But when you recall the fact that they began to show up during World War II, precisely almost 2 years after what I believe to have been the first A-bomb test by the Germans in 1944 over Sweden, And then again in 1947 in this country, in oddly enough, New Mexico, where the first bomb went off that we tested, I think the perception would have been immediately on the part of just everybody's national security establishment that there's something about things here. They're concerned, they're surveilling, and in many cases engaging in provocative or just downright hostile action. So, yeah, I think there's no other way that the national security establishment would have viewed this because of their worst-case scenario mentality. They would have viewed this as a long-term potential threat, and we'd better achieve parity as quickly as we can, and that means we're going to have to secure home base, too.
I always have held that this is the position as well, that the military would come to when they see that, you know, they're screwing with our weaponry here and some of our most powerful weaponry, and yet among the other humans on this planet, this has been seen as a sign of them being peaceful because they don't want us to have these kinds of weapons of mass destruction, etc. So it's a pretty interesting quirk here, because if you were an alien civilization and you came to another planet, let's say we did this with another race, I'm not saying this is the first thing that they did here, but one of the first, you know, one of the first kind of contact things that you do is to kind of begin to mess with their weaponry. That's not a really clever tactic now, is it?
No, it's not a clever tactic, and there are reasons. I don't want to get into them until the book is actually out, because I think that there are reasons why, and I think there are actually justifiable reasons why the military reacted that way and continues to do so. The bottom line is, to just kind of summarize a lot of detail, the bottom line is that with the advent of nuclear weapons, for various reasons, that meant humanity had reached a certain scientific threshold that was immediately perceived as a potential threat. I think the reading of ufologists like Stanton Friedman and others on that score is entirely correct. I think that's the way we are being looked at. And as for the hostility of average people's perception of UFOs, I think, again, that depends on who you ask. I think there's certainly some abductees that would argue that, you know, their experience wasn't very pleasant, and they certainly view whoever these things are or wherever they're coming from as threatening and hostile.
I don't blame them with what they...
No, I don't either.
No.
But, you know, like I say, I think nuclear weapons are the threshold, and I think that means then that we're not as far behind as we might think we are. And this is the other thing that will have occurred to the military immediately. Is if there's this concern, then we're a threat, and the question is, why? Well, first obvious answer is that means we're not as far behind as we think we are. So there's something about it that they would have started to investigate right away.
And so, sorry to interrupt again, Joseph, but is this ultimately then the one of the primary goals with the secret space program is to build a defense system in space to be able to counter this potential threat? And if so, is this then, in your view, legitimate?
This, I think, is one reason for space weapons, but I go back to the analogy. I don't want to elaborate anymore, but I go back to the analogy of World War II. If you're Adolf Hitler and you're planning to invade the Soviet Union, the first thing you got to do is secure France. You know, so what do? You invade Denmark, Norway, France, the Low Countries, and then leave kind of poor old England just to kind of muddle through. I think you're dealing with kind of the same mentality here with respect to the UFO. You've got to secure planet Earth. Get rid of any potential major problems culturally, politically, militarily, economically that you have to confront the long-term problem. Now, I'm going to crawl way out on a limb and suggest that the confrontation that we're talking about may not necessarily be defensive. There are a lot of little indicators, if you read the national security literature closely, that indicate that one of their first concerns is not only whose are these things, but where are they coming from? And if you've been successful in getting a technology, you might have been able to find out from whence they come.
Well, this is interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I know I sound totally kooky, but just...
Not on this
just
radio
just remember that Ben Rich, the former head of the Lockheed Skunk Works, said something very interesting toward the end of his life. He said, "We found an error in the equations, and now we have the technology," note what he said, "to take E.T. home."
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. Mm. Now, talk about a whopper of a statement.
Yeah.
Now, nobody
and no one in the media says, "What? What do you say? Can you clarify that, please?"
Yeah, no one in the media says diddly, and no one that I've been able to talk to that has researched this has given me any indication that the man was, you know, as the British say, barmy at the end of his life. You know, he was in full possession of his faculties, his mind was clear. For a man in that position to say that, well, the real question is, are there any indicators in the record that what he's saying might be true? And oh boy, that's the real story, and I'll leave that for the rest of the book.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, this is very interesting. This is excellent stuff here, and I'm eager to actually get a couple of copies here of both your latest books, and then maybe we can have you back at some point here fairly soon, Joseph, and talk a little bit more about this as well. Because both Breakaway Civilizations and Clash of Civilizations is, of course, connected to all this. And then you mentioned you had the Financial Vipers of Venice. Of course, the history of the black nobility, the Venetians, is a very interesting one. When is this out due, do you think?
It's supposed to be out this fall. It's not really a history of the black nobility, per se. It's more an examination of their strategies and tactics and some of the things that they were fighting against. Some of the concepts, some of the philosophical concepts that I've been writing about in a lot of my books, the Venetians were very, not only very intrigued by them, but they were doing everything they could to stamp them out. it's going to be an interesting book. It's in that Babylon's Banksters series of books. It's the second one in that series. I've got a couple more planned, so... It's kind of step two in that story.
Wow. Well, good work, Joseph, and keep up the good work there. You have a lot of interesting titles already, of course, in the archives, and I definitely suggest everyone to head on over to GizaDeathStar.com and take a look in the bookstore. Check out Joseph's membership there as well and support him and his work so he can continue with this very, very, very fascinating review, if you will, as well, of history and also ongoing geopolitical analysis as well. So thank you, Joseph, for your time today. Fantastic. Great having you back again.
Thanks for having me back, Henrik. It's been a pleasure.
And that's our program for today. Thank you for listening. We have much more to come. Please see our radio archive for upcoming guests. We'll be back in just a few days. Until then, take it easy, and we will talk to you soon.